The truth is, most of us are brushing our teeth wrong. We're not brushing long enough, or we forget to change our brush on time. And that's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. So you ask yourself, what makes Quip so different? Well, for starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that is a fraction of the cost of those bulkier brushes. Quip has a built-in timer that helps you clean for the dentist recommended 2 minutes. Next, Quip's subscription plans are for your health, not just for convenience. They'll deliver new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. And finally, everyone loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O-List, named one of Time's best inventions, and is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers use Quip every day. And I've got even better news. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/nerd right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/nerd. Spelled getquip.com/nerd. If you're coming to Chicago this summer and you're looking for a more honest approach to your improv, well, I have got some great news for you. I'll be teaching my Artist Low Comedy Summer Weekend Intensives on 3 separate weekends here in Chicago. You'll learn in the Artist Low Comedy Weekend Summer Intensive to slow down and shut up so you can start using your feelings in your scenic improv. It'll make improvising as easy as having a conversation. You'll also learn, before you can be funny, you'll need to be real. And guess what? You'll be even funnier in a more genuine and honest way. When you work this way, you'll automatically start to find your unique voice. You'll be tapping into your life experiences without even realizing it. So if you're interested in working this way, I am offering 3 Artist Low Comedy Weekend Summer Intensives on the weekends of July 14th and 15th, July 28th and 29th, and August 11th through the 12th here in Chicago. To sign up, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com.
This is Andiel Sudik, and you're listening to Improv Nerd.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Oh,
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Andiel Sudik. She is an incredible improviser and teacher. She's performed all over the U.S. with the Second City Touring Company and Europe with Boom Chicago. She travels the world and teaches improvisation, and we talked to her about how she got over being fired from the Second City ETC after one review, how she creates her wonderful characters, and she gives 2 really good tips on how she does it. We also improvise a little in this episode, which you'll really like as well. And we talked to her about how the last year and a half has been a really rough year for her and how she's dealing with that. She is an inspiration. You're going to find this interview to be not only thoughtful about improvisation, but candid about her life. Before we get to the episode with Andiel, I just want to say Sunday was Father's Day. It was my 2nd official Father's Day. And it really started out badly, I have to say. Lauren tried to keep Betsy quiet so I could sleep in till about 7:30. And that didn't work. Betsy was crying, and Lauren was trying really hard. She kept moving her down a floor, you know, to see if she wouldn't wake me up. But Betsy wouldn't stop crying. She's 2 years old, and it doesn't matter what you say to a 2-year-old. They're not going to stop crying. Well, by the time I got into the basement, Betsy was continuing to having a meltdown. And then when I got down there, Lauren was upset that I was up, right? And so she had a meltdown. And then I tried to tell Lauren what to do because I can't deal with, you know, that all that anger, which then Lauren got mad at me. And I'm like, oh my God, is this what Father's Day is all about? So enough about me. You're going to love this interview with Andiel Sudik. Like I said, she is so honest about her life and is so, you're going to get so many great pointers and tips about improvisation, especially how she approaches characters, because she does really, really wonderful characters. Here it is, the Andiel Sudik episode. Enjoy. Andiel Sudik, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you for having me.
You were raised in a suburb outside of Los Angeles.
Yes, I was.
Both your parents were in the theater. They were actors.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like growing up?
As a kid, amazing, awesome. They were both, very into creativity and nurturing that, and just weirdos, wonderful weirdos.
When you say weirdos, what kind of, I love weirdos.
Right.
I'm a weirdo.
Oh, yeah, aren't we all? Just constantly embarrassing. Like, I played softball growing up, and my dad's nickname on that team was the Yell King, because he was just the head cheerleader, would just, like, climb on the fence, do whatever it took to get us riled up. It was very embarrassing in my teenage years. But also cool to look back.
Were they like supportive? Because you started doing theater pretty early, right?
Yeah. I mean, all my life I did theater. And then as soon as I was an adult, moved to pursue it. And they were 1,000% supportive along the way.
What did they ever give you advice about theater and acting?
I would say my dad was my first director. So just everything, he would give me advice. I remember, the very first thing was when I was, 12 years old, I really wanted to get an agent because I grew up in California. And he was like, if you memorize two monologues and a song, you can get an agent. And so that was, the first way of him kind of, teaching me discipline or teaching me that there was,
Do you remember stuff. What that monologue was?
Yes, I do. I learned Happy Birthday, Wanda June, which is a Kurt Vonnegut play, but it's a little girl in heaven who has died. And then I also learned his monologue from Waiting for Godot. So I learned a comedic and a serious.
And you did get an agent, right?
I did. I actually, when I was 15, was scouted in a production of The Music Man and was brought into audition for this pilot. And they hired me, but the guy who hired me wasn't comfortable with me working without an agent. So I went through this weird thing where I got an agent. I got headshots. I decided I wanted to be blonde for the headshots. So I dyed my hair blonde and we brought the headshots to the agent. And they're like, oh, we actually kind of your goth look. So do you mind re-dyeing your hair black?
Were you a goth kid?
No, but I did love to dye my hair. So my hair was black. So that just read as goth.
In that pilot that you did, it was a TV mm-hmm. pilot.
Yeah.
You get exposed to improv.
Yes. Yeah. So the pilot was just such a cool experience looking back on it. But it was this idea of these kids had a TV show. So it was basically SCTV for kids. We ran the TV show. So I was technically the camera person and also one of the players and got to improvise bits in it. I got to improvise a news piece. Yeah.
And then also at this time, you're driving up to Santa Monica,
yeah.
and you're seeing a lot of the Second City alumni
yeah.
doing Harold's one night a week. I think it was a Wednesday,
Wednesday night. Yeah.
And they would do three Harolds. Mm-hmm. They would pick their names out of the hats.
Yeah.
And you became kind of a groupie.
Absolutely. Me and my friend Amanda Oley, who I moved out to Chicago with years later, we would go down religiously. It was our religion. And we had inside jokes about that show for years that make no sense going back. But we would pay $5, go into this weird restaurant and watch the most incredible thing I'd ever seen in my life.
What was it that, coming from a theater background, mm-hmm. Oh my God, I love this.
Yeah. It was just magic. Just watching people who you knew, they were picking it up out of nothing. So they picked it up out of nothing and then weaved together characters, and they would have reoccurring characters and things would come back and it would tie together in an unexplainable way. So kind of that that magic when you first see improv, if you're seeing good improv.
And then you graduated from high school and mm-hmm. you moved to Chicago yeah. and you sign up to go to Columbia College.
Yes, I decided I was going to go to Columbia College for a theater degree, and that was really just my way of getting to Chicago. I knew I wanted to be in Chicago. And so I moved out. I registered for classes, which I remember being so annoying and taking so long. And then a week before classes start, I was like, nah, quit.
Why did you quit?
I quit because I didn't want to be in debt for a theater degree. And I had already started taking improv classes and kind of fell in love with doing that. So I wanted to kind of give all my energy to that.
And you started at the I.O., Chicago. That's where you started to take classes. And I actually met you. The first time I met you was I was directing My Naked Friends.
Yes.
And so we met. And then shortly after that, we worked together. You get hired to a touring company at 19 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. Which was great. you feel so special when you're like the little kid. And it's also weird because I think like, the very first gig I did for Second City was a corporate gig, and I remember the cast. I only remember some of them, but it was Jen Eslin, Martin Garcia, and Keegan-Michael Key. So that's three of the people I was going out with. So they're all 10 or 20 years older than me and just really good at their job, and that's it.
And how was that? Like, were you intimidated by those guys or did they take you under your wing?
Oh, so that gig, we were in Texas and Martin Garcia actually took us to his mom's house. So like that, and then also I couldn't go to bars. And so we walked down, is it 6th Avenue in Austin? There's like whatever the music street is. We walked down the street and they kept walking with me until we found a hotel where we could all go hang out. So it was like, they were incredibly gracious and generous. And I was so intimidated and very just trying to suck it all in.
So you do that for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. I toured for 2 years.
And then you decide, you go to Amsterdam, you audition for Boom Chicago, you get in.
Yeah.
And you describe that experience, the best of times and the worst of times.
Absolutely. It was, so I moved there pretty young.
You're 21, right? 22?
20, maybe 23 or 24, okay. I think, when I moved. Yeah, because it was a year after touring I went.
How did you decide to quit touring? Because a lot of the most people hang in the touring company as long as they can so they can get one of the stages.
Yeah, so that there's, I mean, it was so long ago, I've probably rewritten the story in my head. But 2 years was about the length that people toured for in around then. And my 2 years was up and the cast had completely changed over and we had written a Christmas show and I was happy with what I had contributed and I thought I had gotten all I was going to get out of touring and decided like I was done. And ships became like, that's when ships were created. Like
ships, you would go on a boat.
Yeah.
And you know, for an improviser, you were making $600-$800, right?
A week.
Right. And then you subletted your apartment you probably came off the boat pretty well off an improviser.
Oh, especially at that point too, because that was like when they first existed, they were giving them to alumni and like people who were done with the job before they moved to LA. So it was basically a way to make enough money to move. So I did a ship and then went to Boom, basically.
So you go to Boom. Mm-hmm. Best of times, worst of times. We got off track. My fault.
Sorry.
Tell me what was best about it.
Best about it, the people that I met there and the people that I got to work with are some of the kindest, most talented people. And because it is such a bizarre situation, you're moving to a foreign country, you've got a cast of like 12 people and they're the people that you know, it's kind of, you get really close to a lot of them and got to learn a lot. I learned a lot. I got to perform for really different audiences.
What was that like? What did you learn from that? Because you do like 6 or 8 shows a week, right?
Oh, yeah. So you're working ideally 6 days a week, either in the theater or doing corporate gigs. So you've got kind of like a bigger cast that can do both of those things. And you just learn when you're performing for an audience that isn't necessarily, that English isn't their first language, that pop culture doesn't fly, pop culture references just don't work, and you can play a little bit bigger and a little bit broader.
So what do you rely on in those situations?
For me, I rely on emotion and physical comedy, which is lucky because that's what I went out there with, right? So going out there with those things that were already the things that I did well made the transition easier.
So when you play characters, you amp up the emotion.
Balls to
you,
the wall,
you
yeah.
amp up the physicality of it.
Yeah, you amp up the intensity of the stakes. So kind of playing things a little bit bigger, a little bit louder.
Almost kind of short form in a way.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of it was either straight up short form games, or it would be like sketches that had room for improvisation. So you'd have like touch points that you had to get to, or characters that you'd play, but there was room for improv within them.
What was the worst part of it?
The worst part was I was very young, and there was a pretty solid drug culture out there. And a cool boys club. So the boys club aspect of it was very hard. And I think working there made me stronger in a lot of ways. And it also put armor on me for much longer than I needed the armor, if that makes sense.
So what did you do to overcome the cool boys club?
I found the strong women that worked there, because the women that I worked with are some of the best. I worked with Lauren Flans, who's in LA now, Hillary Bauman. I worked with Amber Ruffin, Liz Bolton, Jen Burton. So these are all incredibly strong women, both on stage and off stage. And I think they made the experience much better.
And what year are we talking about?
So I was there, I believe, 2007 to 2009.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a feeling that it's changed since?
I mean, it's changed a lot. I don't in some good, some bad ways, I think. Like anything. I'm 25 years old. Mm-hmm. So I think, too, like, even just looking at that it's lasted that long is mind-blowing.
And what do you think it is about Boom Chicago? So you think of the alumni mm-hmm. that have come out of there. You got Seth Meyers, Jordan Peele, Jason mm-hmm. Sudeikis, Kay Cannon. You mentioned Amber Ruffin, mm-hmm. Ike Barinholtz. Yeah. What do you think it is?
That makes it...
Well, people out of there seem mm-hmm. to have successful careers.
Because you're working, right? So you're doing a lot. You're learning to work in a different way, in a different context. So if you're coming from the States and you already understand an American audience, either in sketch comedy or long form or short form, you go out there and you get to work your chops. Like, you get to work acting. You get to learn how to work for a different type of audience. You do a lot of writing and you do a lot of performing. So you get so much more experience in such a condensed amount of time in such a bubble out there. So I think you just get to work. And a lot of people that go out there find themselves either as artists or as people, I think.
We didn't mention about the drug culture, but did you get caught up in it?
Oh, 1,000%. I acted, and I still think it's wreaked havoc on my brain and my body. Like, I think I've aged, I think I'm like 60 years old because of it. Like, because
it's so accessible?
It's so accessible, and depending on the cast that you come into, it's the cool things. Like, I walked in and we were immediately like, let's do all the drugs. And so I did drugs like I was a 300-pound man. Like,
But you can go in, I've never been there, but you can go into cafes, right, and do hashish and...
Yeah, so it's a little bit different now. But when I was there, you go into coffee shops and you get pot, you get any kind. There's it's a menu. So you get different kinds of highs from different kinds of weeds. There was mushrooms were legal. So you could go into a store and get mushrooms. You could also call cabs that would bring you beer or ecstasy or cocaine. So, like, there's just too many options for an addictive personality.
And this is before that you come into terms with your depression, correct?
Oh, yeah. So this was before I had a diagnosis or had even started to think that therapy was an option. So I go out there as a 24-year-old and lose my mind. In several different ways.
So you come back mm-hmm. in one piece, right?
Yeah, mostly, yeah.
Okay.
You know, a little worn.
And you go back and you do the boats for a while, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And then Second City calls you here in Chicago, and they say, hey, we'd like you to join the next ETC cast.
Yes. So I finally got it. Finally got that carrot.
Was that a goal of yours?
Oh, huge goal, yeah. From the moment that I got hired to Tourco, I wanted a stage. And I think that's true of a lot of people who come come and do Second City.
And you do the show,
mm-hmm.
and this blew my mind, that your entire cast gets flown to New York mm-hmm. to audition for Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Including yourself.
Yes.
Tell us about the audition.
Okay. It's very surreal. So we opened the show. We basically opened the show, and that weekend got calls from the producer that said, we'd like to fly you out. So
had they come and seen the show?
They came to see the show, yeah. So they came to see us on our opening weekend, and like Lorne and the writers came backstage and were...
You got to meet Lorne?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
His face is so beautiful. It's like porcelain powder. Like, I feel like he looks like Rich. He looks like what Rich feels like.
Okay.
So they come back and they're very kind. And we get a call from the producers.
He comes back to the backstage of ETC, that little green room.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think...
Were you nervous or excited or both?
I think that I was just high off the fumes of like having a super successful show, because it's also opening weekend. So the audiences were really hot. We weren't bored of any of the material, so we were super hot. And you could just feel the energy of all of us having a really good show and being really proud, I think, of what we created. And so, yeah, you have that weird phone call where they tell you what to bring and what's going on. And then for me, I'd never written solo material. So then it's like, great, I've got a week to work on some stuff.
And what do they ask you to do?
So they tell you it's 5 minutes. It's a hard 5 minutes. They recommend doing 3 characters and 3 impersonations. But if you don't do impersonations, don't do that. And then they said, what we loved about you, particularly on stage, was the physical comedy. So we'd love to see that in your audition.
Was this a goal of yours?
1,000% since the first time I saw SNL.
When was the first time you saw it?
My dad would play it, so we would get to stay up late and watch it.
Which cast was it?
So that cast would have been Mike Myers and Dana Carvey, would have been like the cast that I consider like my SNL cast. And then late at night, they would play the original cast.
The John Belushi,
Gilda Radner,
Jane Curtin, mm-hmm. Bill Murray.
Yeah, and so... Those were the kind of
when you called your parents and told them, what was their reaction?
So what's crazy is my dad and my niece were in town to see the show. So they were with me when I got the call. So we were walking down the street. It was like 3,000 degrees, summer in Chicago. And I get the call from the producer from SNL. So I get to hang up, turn to my niece and my dad and be like, I'm getting flown out to audition. So it was just really... a cool moment.
And what happens when you go?
So I went and we checked into the hotel and my room wasn't ready. So AD Bryant,
who was also in the cast.
Who's also in the cast that I was in, let me hang out in her room, like just to hang out because I didn't have a place to go, which was so kind. And then we all went over separately. We all had different call times. So I was first in. So I walk into the building, into the makeup room, and it's a bunch of New York makeup artists, and they're all chatting and shooting the shit, and they're all fantastic. And so I get to sit in the room and have them do my makeup, and they ask, like, what do you want us to do? And they're like, I don't know, make me pretty. And they're like, okay, whatever. And then you go and you sit in your room and you wait to get called. So you basically go from, like, being completely alone in a room, the stage manager comes to get you, and he's great. He's like, it's a quiet room. It's a cold room. Don't worry about it. And they do everything they can to make you comfortable. You go in. It's over in a flash. I feel like I blacked out during it. I got one laugh at the end that was not part of my bits. And then I went and sat in the room and waited until they come get you after the
show. And what did you feel how you did?
I knew I did not do well.
How'd you know that?
Because no one laughed was one reason that's pretty obvious. But also it's that kind of the realization that you've wanted this thing for a long time, but you haven't done the thing you knew you needed to do. Like I knew that the audition was solo material, but I'd never written solo material before. So I hadn't been practicing that craft. Like I'd been doing sketch comedy, but I'd never written just solo material. So kind of that realization of like, oh, you don't want the first time you're doing something to be that high stakes. So I left. I wasn't embarrassed. I just felt like it was like a nothing, like I wouldn't remember me. So kind of that, like, it was a first audition type of thing.
And so how do you deal with that? Do you go to the bar? Do you see to get some pot? Do you go get a pizza?
Well, what was great was I was there with my cast. Like, I was there with Tawny Newsome and Adie Bryant. And so all of us afterwards, like, who were all kind of dazed from the experience, went across the street and got the most expensive steak dinner I think I've ever gotten in my life.
Now, when you're at that dinner, Are you talking about it? Are you guys, like, so, like, emotionally drained? And it's, in a way, it's kind of a traumatic experience, though it's exciting.
Yeah.
What are you guys talking about at that dinner?
We talked about it. We all talked about our auditions and our bits, which also keyed me into, like, oh, they did much better than I did. But what's cool is, like, because you are there to share their experience, it also takes a little bit of the sting out of your own if you've had a, like, less than perfect one. So we talked about our auditions and then probably talked about, like, how we were flying back the next day to do the show.
So you fly back to Chicago. Mm-hmm. Adie gets hired. Bryan gets hired to Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
You do the show. Mm-hmm. You're in rehearsal for the second show.
Yes.
And a couple weeks into it, you get fired.
Yes. It was devastating. That was like – so like – that was probably the roughest year and a half, I think, of my life up until the last year and a half. Because it was like, you know, you have an audition for the job you've always wanted and you don't get it. And then a year later, you're fired from your dream job. And everyone you know, everyone in your community knows. And so it's hard to figure out where you fit back in, I think. So that was devastating.
How did you get over that disappointment?
One was I discovered therapy for the first time in my own life. That was the first time I had ever had health insurance because for equity points, I had enough equity points.
It's just the second city. Yeah. If you're working one of the stages, you become an equity actor.
Yeah, if you get enough weeks. And so I had equity points and finally was like, oh, I can afford to go to a therapist because my copay is decent. And even like after I got fired, I still had, you know, some time. So started seeing a therapist, which was massive, and started on antidepressants, which was also really helpful to kind of get me out of that, like, the hole where I didn't, you know, like, my sister describes it as being underwater. It was just underwater, and I couldn't get myself out.
Had you been underwater for a long time?
I had suffered from low-level depression my entire life, and so just had never been diagnosed or had never – I didn't grow up in a family that did therapy, so, like, didn't know how to do that or that was an option. And it kind of, like, yeah, not known how, I think. And that kind of – that experience, that devastation, shocked me into needing to find something. Like, I remember it was, like, 3 days after the firing, I, like, hadn't slept. And I went to a clinic and was going to check myself in. And, like, got all the information. And I was like, maybe you should just try a therapist first. So, yeah, that devastation kind of, like, shocked me into, like, your reaction to this is huge. And it's insurmountable. There has to be something that you're capable and in power to do.
And then what would you tell Andiel today to Andiel who got 3 days after getting fired from Second City? What advice would you give her?
What advice would I give her? This will end. What you're in now will end. And you do have friends. Reach out.
Did you not think you had friends after that?
No, because I think part of the depression and part of what happened, like, made me so insecure as a human and as this field that I've chosen to work in, because it was so much of my identity. Like, at that point, I had worked on and off for Second City for, like, 8 years. So much of my identity was tied to this building and what I did in it. So to have that taken away in such a big way, it felt like everything had been taken away.
Do you ever, like, this is what I do, and this is why I'm crazy, but do you, you get fired and then you go back, you just keep playing it back. Like, if I would have done this and that and done this and that, it might not have happened. Was there any of that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
well, and some of it's true. So, like, some of it was like, oh, I wasn't my best, like, I wasn't my best person in this situation. So some of it, luckily, I could work on as a human, which felt very
like, give me
empowering.
An example. Of
I had been hardened so much by having to constantly – take care of myself in casts. And I think in that situation too, that my initial, like, I was a little bit shut down, I would say. So like, very good at taking care of myself, not as good as being vulnerable, at being vulnerable. So I think it was hard for me.
On stage or in the process?
In the process, mm-hmm. So I think like, it was hard for me to let my guard down because there was so much of like taking care of myself on stage and making sure that I was represented and that as a woman, I wasn't in any position that I didn't want to be in. Cause working with so many male directors, and castmates and having that balance off, I do think I had to take care of myself. And so a lot of it was like that kind of like the power that comes from aggression. I think I'd like keyed into that a little too far and didn't quite know how to do the other side of it. So I never felt safe. I never felt safe. So I never acted safe.
And how do you, for people that are listening to this podcast that don't feel safe, mm-hmm. how do you feel safe in a cast and with a director?
Well, I think what's cool about what's happening in the last year or two is people are starting to have a voice. So in many ways where there was no one listening to me or there was no one to go to.
Had you gone to management?
We had gone to management as a cast and talked about some stuff and felt not listened to as we went into our second process. And certainly like within rehearsal rooms also had been shut down, I would say, or like you have to be the unfun person in the room sometimes when you're taking care of yourself, right?
Right.
And
so much of it, I think, comes down to the personality. Like
yeah.
If the person's been in the cast long enough, mm-hmm. you know, and they're if it's a you know, is a leader, they're
yeah.
and has an ear to the mm-hmm. ear to the producer, they're going to be heard a little more.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a personality thing too as well.
Yeah, and there's a lot of dynamics. And I like still believe at Second City, and hopefully it's starting to change, but that like women don't get a lot of second chances here and men get a lot of second chances. And
Why do you think that is?
I think systematic oppression and systematic sexism. And I think it's true too when we talk about minorities, like there have been issues that are at least starting to come to light. Whether or not they'll change, it's going to be messy. I think we're in a messy time, but people are starting to speak up and take care of themselves in a way that I don't know a lot of people were for a long time, if that makes sense. Yeah.
So if you're in a situation like that, mm-hmm. today management is going to listen a little more, do you think?
I think they have to, or you're going to go post on social media and then they have to. So I think there's more outlets. And I also think there's a stronger community to go to. So you have more allies. So you're not the only person in the room feeling something and having no one to talk to about it. I think people are starting to find more modes of communication and more support systems. And knowing that they have a choice, right? Like I can stay in the situation, I can try to change it or change myself. And if none of that is working, I can remove myself. I think people are smarter and taking care of themselves.
We got to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back after this. In the Artist Loc Comedy Summer Weekend Intensives, I want to give you some tools that will help you take your improv to the next level. Now, if you've been around, you've been improvising for a while, you may feel like you're in a rut, like you're doing the same scenes over and over and over again. Or you just are like, I want to get inspired again. I want to get excited about improv like when I first started. I think when we've been improvising for a while, we make it harder than it needs to be. We put added pressure that we don't need to put on ourselves. And in the Artist Loc Comedy Summer Weekend Intensive, I want to make improv for you as easy as having a conversation. In the Artist Loc Comedy Weekend Summer Intensive, you'll learn to slow down and shut up so you can start using your feelings to create all you need for your scene work. Also, you'll learn before you can be funny, you need to be real. And guess what? You're going to be even funnier in a more genuine and honest way. And I get it. Not everybody wants to improvise this way. I'm not going to take it personally. And if you are interested, I'm offering 3 Artist Loc Comedy Weekend Summer Intensives here in Chicago, the weekend of July 14th and 15th, July 28th and 29th, and August 11th and 12th. To sign up, all you need to do is go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com.
In this millennial.
And then, so you get fired from Second City, but and you continue to teach, and you have to come into this building. How was that?
So toxic. Because it was like, it was literally like, I got the call that I got fired and had to clean out my cubby that I'd been in for over a year.
So you didn't even get a last night?
No, I didn't get a last night. I'm still crushed by that. I never got a last night.
I think that we should start a petition. That is, don't you think?
It's, yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, it sucked. Well, they were in process, so they had to, like, move forward
quickly. I understand that, but couldn't we say, okay, tonight we're going to have a last night? So they call you, and then they say, tomorrow go and clean out your cubby?
Yeah.
So you don't even have a last show?
No. Nope. No, I didn't.
Oh, I'm getting mad.
It's a process. But so I cleaned that out and then had to come in later that night and teach. And that was like, that was a hard thing. And also,
Did you show up to the class with your box, you know, like really sad?
Yeah, just like super forlorn. Right. I played my own music. Yeah. It was all like really deep violin.
Warm up yourself.
Yeah.
You know?
But I also think that
today we're going to work on sad. I got rejection scenes. Just disappointment. Like
really like leaned into my pain.
Right.
I also will say like what was nice was having that thing to still be able to do. So I can't completely like it's all complicated. Like nice that they didn't fire me from everything. Why would they? I'm a wonderful teacher. But what was also great, I'll say, and helped me out of that really rough patch was another director from Second City who I'd worked with before reached out and asked me to be a part of a cast. The producers and that director of theatricals asked me to be a part of a different cast that was going to La Jolla. To La Jolla, California.
Okay.
And so knowing that someone still respected and appreciated.
How long did that come after the firing?
Maybe a month or two. I don't remember. Okay. Not too long. It was pretty quick.
So you had at least 8 therapy sessions in between that time.
Exactly. So I was, you know, like had figured some stuff out
before. And you could say yes, because if it was me and I didn't have any therapy, it would have been like, F you. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, totally.
I'm done with you, you know?
Well, I think it was like I was so depressed and so insecure that I took a lot of it on myself. So I think like – which was helpful because it made me feel in control. Like I can change these things. Because I had no control over the situation, right?
Well, so you were taking all the blame?
A little bit, yeah.
Oh, I can relate to this. Yeah.
Yeah, and so like it's
doesn't it make it better for a while?
It does. You well, because it also gives you something to focus on that's actionable, and that gives you something to do.
But
versus
I bet you,
spiraling.
Yeah, but I bet your therapist was like, "It's not all your fault."
Yeah, she was great about. Unwinding things and being like, well, here is what your depression did during this time and what made these things happen. And here are other things. And also be kind to yourself. Right. There was a lot of that.
Yeah. But it's interesting. It's something that I still struggle with is this, my identity as a performer, my self-worth is tied up in performing.
Totally.
And now what you've always, you know, here, you know, being on one of the stages, that's a huge accomplishment. And you have a lot of status in the community and you're feeling great about yourself, but it's taken away from you. And it's like, oh my God, you know.
Everything's gone.
Yeah. So how have you been reconciled with that? Because that is something I still struggle with. I do a bad show I just want to die. I just want to crawl up into a hole and die.
Right. Well, I don't react that way to bad shows because I know there's always another one. So, like, I'm good on that. And just, like, filling out other aspects of my life and also trying to be what I felt was lacking when I worked. So trying to be a director that listens, trying to be more conscious as a performer, trying to be more kind to myself so that I can be more kind to my teammates or my castmates.
And that's really where it starts, doesn't it? You got to be – if you don't like yourself and you're not kind to yourself, you are – the chances that you're going to be kind and nice to other people
– right. What was amazing was like the one of my first sessions or second sessions, her just being like I would just get like really tied up and angry or irritable about like or like upset by things that people were doing. My therapist was like, well, that is a symptom of depression. I was like, what? So just like unwrapping that stuff too was fun. Yeah.
Let's talk about your teaching, because you have a great reputation, not only here at Second City, but now across the world. Mm-hmm. And you stress two things. Mm-hmm. Honesty is one, mm-hmm. and the other is body movement.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the honesty first?
Yeah. So I think what I try to do as a teacher is bring myself 100% into the room, whatever that is, and be as honest as I can. And allow that of my students as well, of like whatever, wherever we are today, whoever we are today, let's use that because it's easier.
So give me an example of how you come into the room and you're like, I'm going to be 100% who I am in this moment today.
I answer questions honestly. I think I don't subscribe to like everything is always supposed to be happy and easy because I don't believe that's the way the world works. So I don't believe that's how we have to work in a room.
Because there is kind of a – and I certainly feel it sometimes, this pressure of it's got to be a party. People have to have a good time in improv class. And I will actually leave improv classes thinking that I failed if it gets challenging. And what I've learned too is that's usually when they're learning the most.
Yeah, that's my – like my favorite quote and my mantra when I take a class, so one that I try to share with my classes – is you can't get better and look good at the same time. And for a perfectionist, that is so nice to remind yourself of. It's like, oh, I feel terrible. I look like an asshole. I must be getting better.
I find it very funny. I'm a perfectionist too, that I think there's a lot of us in improv. Yeah. And do you ever think, like, why does improv
draw us?
Yes.
For me personally, on stage is the only place where I can let go of that critical brain. So when I'm improvising, I don't think. And so for me, it's the only place I can do that easily. Like it just naturally happens. Like I come alive on stage, have a great time. I get off stage, I overthink it. I think of what could have been better. So I think it gives you the option of being in the moment, which I think is hard for perfectionists, I think. Maybe.
So tell us how you get people to be honest, if there's an exercise or some sort of a game that you play with your students to give an honest response to what's going on in a scene.
Right. Well, it depends on what type of class it is for sure. But something really easy is just to start scenes with that honesty. So have one person start with a piece of object work and an emotion. Have the second person enter that scene and look at their scene partner, get an actual feeling. So instead of putting on an emotion or putting on a feeling, have a feeling.
Okay, so if I was going to start a scene and I'm since we're on, this is an audio thing, it's weird.
My stuff's physical.
Right. So I'm like, you know, I'm drinking out of a mug, right? And I'm and then you come into the scene. Mm-hmm.
We check in. Oh, you're sad and I feel responsible. That was the honest thing that I felt in that
moment. Okay, so then how would you put that into the first piece of dialogue?
I would probably let it be silent for a really long time. I also love silent scenes. So I probably wouldn't force an initiation. I'd allow that moment to take us where it wanted to happen. I'd probably go to another place. I'm thinking the faucet is where I'm going. I'm going to start washing dishes. And so now we both have something that's going on. Your feeling and emotion has inspired mine. You've been able to check in with what I'm doing and get something from me. And then we move forward.
And now I feel like in this moment, like you're my daughter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to say, you know, your mother and I are very disappointed that you didn't come home till this morning.
I was out.
I know, but you have a 12:30 curfew.
I know, but I was out.
With Peter?
Yes. So?
Well, we're worried about you.
Well, I'm fine. Would you rather I was out alone? On the streets alone?
Colleen, don't roll your eyes at me, okay? Now, your mother hasn't said anything.
I know.
Okay?
Yeah.
Are you guys... I can't even say it.
Well, don't then.
Well, I need to know.
No, you don't. You need to know what, Dad? What can't you say? You need to know
Colleen,
what?
Colleen,
what do you need to know?
Colleen, I think you know what I'm about to say.
I'm not a mind reader. What? Colleen, what do you need to know?
I think you know.
Oh, I don't.
I don't. Please. Colleen.
No, please, you.
I have to go to work in 10 minutes.
Fine. Then go.
Okay. Do you want your mother to continue this conversation?
I don't care.
Well, she may ground you.
So?
I don't know where you get such an attitude. Okay? Please, stop with the eye rolls. Colleen?
What?
Are you and Peter?
What?
Colleen, please, you know what I mean.
I don't know what you mean.
Yes.
Are we hanging out and dancing? Yes.
What happens after dancing?
I don't know. Getting tired. Are me and Peter getting tired together? Yes.
Colleen?
What?
Okay.
Sweating? Are we sweating? Yes.
Okay.
What? Ask what you want to ask.
I think I've made it clear.
Fine.
Are you?
Are we what?
Colleen.
If you can't say it, then I don't have to answer.
Okay, so here's the thing. You were born because your mother and I.
Are you freaking kidding me right now?
I'm not. I'm being your father.
Okay. Good job, Dad.
Okay. So your mother and I had you because we did something in the bedroom together.
Played records?
Colleen.
What?
We did play records.
Oh, cool.
Okay. We played Marvin Gaye. I don't think I have to spell this out for you.
Okay? I think if you want an answer, you're going to have to.
Colleen.
What? Are you done?
I'm going to write it down on a piece of paper.
Okay.
It's three letters.
I've gone blind.
Colleen.
I can't read.
Colleen, stop it.
I can't see.
Colleen, please, just stop it.
You stop it.
Here. Colleen, don't eat it. Oh, for God's sake. All right, so that was a lot of fun.
That was delightful. I had a blast.
So what was so fun? So what was it about the beginning of that scene that locked us in, that gave us space for me to say, okay, you're my daughter, there's sadness, all of this? I'm just guessing it has something to do with working in silence at the beginning.
Yeah, I think patience. I think patience and connection. So for me, the connection of two people, of you, Jimmy, and me, Andiel. We are two people. We have energy together. And using what's actually there instead of putting on something makes it so much easier and more fun to play, because then we're working with what's already between us. And I think a lot of times in improv, we jump to words or we jump to ideas instead of allowing the actual two people on stage to connect.
And what is that connection, would you say? If you could describe that?
I don't know. In words? See, that's the other thing. I'm like such not a word person. Energy. I guess energy.
And you get it really by, I think, taking your time. Now, some people are going to say, well, I can get a connection like that. It doesn't have to be slow.
Awesome. That works too. I also, like working at Boom, so I do slow comedy. I do fast comedy. I do dumb bits. I think there's room for all of it. My thing is, when you're playing a big character, still play it from a place of honesty using yourself. So if you're taking this and you want to play right away, then I'd say just pick a character trait that you actually have and heighten it and use that as inspiration for the stakes of your scene or for your character.
You do a lot of characters, as I remember.
I do a lot of characters.
And how do you develop them?
Playing. I play like a kid. I think it's all about playing. Yeah.
Do you have stock characters that you use? Are you discovering new ones as you go along?
Yeah, I'm discovering new ones as I go along, because in the last 5 years, I've started giving myself permission and giving myself my own notes or goals. I think for a long time, I waited for teachers or directors to tell me stuff, but I know me better. I know how to challenge myself. So
give me an example how you do set a goal for yourself.
Great.
Challenge yourself.
So this weekend I did a festival in Gladstone, Missouri. And for one of the shows, my whole intention going in, and I didn't tell my partner, which is kind of shitty but also very fun, was I'm really going to play with silence. And then another.
What does that mean for you?
For me, that means within a scene, instead of responding right away, which I normally would in a lot of scenes, I'll wait and react and go to the scene work, go to the object work. And whether or not that gives my scene partner pause or forces them to want to fill the air, that'll do something funky.
Well, you were lucky because you were working with an experienced, one of the best improvisers that I've worked with is John Hildreth.
Yeah, it was very
so
cool.
He's probably discovering, because you guys haven't worked together, have you? So he's trying to figure out your rhythm to things, which is scary.
Oh, yeah.
And fun at the same time.
Yeah. And so then, like, another challenge I might give myself in a different setting is play a character you've never played before. And I would initiate that or activate that either by physicality or by intention.
So I have something that I've struggled with is – I seem to go back to the same characters because it's safe. What would you suggest for me to like, okay, try new characters. Here's a little tip to try new characters.
Do it on your own so that you're in a place where you don't have to worry about what the group thinks if that's part of it. My favorite way to immediately jump into monologues is to create a list of words you would use to describe people, create a list of occupations, match them up randomly, jump into a one-minute monologue.
So give me an example.
You've got angry, delighted, flippant, angry, delighted, or flippant, and then you've got a dog groomer, a mortician, or a kid at a Valentine's Day dance. So just match up two of those things. So you're a flippant dog groomer, and then you just go into it. You just go into words.
Wow.
Yeah. Is that hard?
And you do that, when you said it, I'm just like, I'm scared me and shut down.
Okay. So then I would say for you, do something totally different.
Okay.
Yeah. So if that shut you down, then I would say for you, stand with a different body lead. So if you normally sit pretty hunched. So I might.
I do too.
Give myself a chest body lead. I might say like, this makes me feel pissed off.
I'm doing the same thing and I feel real stiff.
So that makes you feel stiff.
I almost feel like a bodybuilder. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then like, hey man.
Hey.
What's up? You working that machine?
I'm taking a break right now. Yeah. But I just did 10 reps.
Yeah. Pretty cool. I just did 20. So.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No big deal. Do you want that water bottle? Can you toss it to me?
Here. Thanks, it's all yours.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'd say physicality might be a key into messing around. It's hard to do, I think like if you're in a rehearsal group or just doing shows, I think it's really hard to try.
So you don't ever try to bring out a new character in a show?
Absolutely, I do.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, but my activation, so I think you're always looking for what your door in is, right? So my door in is probably going to be physicality because I don't have to think about it. So if I walk a different way, I think a different way. So that's going to be what starts me off. And then the suggestion or the input from my scene partner and the audience is going to give me something more to play with.
So if you were, you know, like more slouchy, you may be tired, you may have a little attitude, something like that. And that's what you come into. And then as the scene goes on, you're discovering more and more
why?
About your character.
Yeah, you're discovering
Tell me
why.
This why thing because I never – fully understood it.
I'm discovering why I am that way or why I'm presenting that way. So I'm not just tired and hunched over. Like those are just words. There needs to be a reason. And often your reason's going to be tied into your partner. So like if I'm hunched over and tired. And then we're doing a scene and our suggestion is bar, right? Then you get to give yourself a why along the way. And I think in long form, we get the joy of discovering the why. So throughout the scene, if I'm the bartender, we get to discover what that is.
Yeah, like, could I get another beer, Chuck?
Yeah, Chuck. Big night, huh?
Yeah, it was a big night.
Yeah?
I'm going to need to run a tab.
Okay. All right. We don't normally do that, and you know that, Chuck.
I know.
Okay. We're starting to tab.
Yeah, I know.
All right, you're two in already.
So that's $7.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm keeping track.
Okay. Big night?
Yeah.
Okay. You going back out after this?
Gonna try. Gonna try.
I don't know if that's a great. I don't know if that's a great idea.
No, I can drive.
I don't. Well, I'm not. Oh no, Chuck, give me your keys.
No, I can't.
Chuck, you gotta give me your keys.
No,
Chuck.
No, I don't really want.
Give me your keys or share a secret. Okay. It's the rules. Give me your keys or share a secret.
Okay, I'll share a secret.
Where were you tonight?
I was at Carol's.
Oh, Chuck, you can't go back to Carol's.
I did.
You know what that does to you, man.
I know. I'm weak.
You gotta get strong.
She wouldn't take me back again.
Yeah, I know. You've done this like 3 times in the past month, buddy.
I bought her a microwave.
What? You?
I bought her a microwave.
Is that what's in the bag?
Yeah, she wouldn't take it this time.
Why would she take? What is that, Chuck? What is that, man? You gotta stop buying your ex appliances.
I love her. I want to get back with her.
Well, that's obviously not the way to her heart. It's 3 times in a month, and she has not bit. Maybe you're barking up the wrong tree, man.
No, we're meant to be. I told you.
I know you told me that, but it does not seem through the actions that is true.
We are in love. She just can't admit it.
Okay. Now you got to stop. This is killing you, and I can't imagine.
She's dating Fred, okay? She's dating that guy to get me jealous.
I think she's probably dating him because she likes him.
Whose side are you on? Whose side are you on?
I am on the side of truth, love, and justice.
Well, it doesn't sound like it.
All right. You just slammed that one. You want another one?
Yeah. Okay. I got a big screen TV, and I need some help to get it up to a place.
I am not helping you carry a television.
I can't carry a 50-inch screen TV myself.
And you shouldn't. And you shouldn't get someone to help you.
This is my last chance.
You're basically stalking your ex, man.
It's not stalking. I'm giving her stuff. I'm not hiding in the bushes.
Is she taking it?
Not the first time I offer it to her.
See, it's like if you love something, you got to let it go, Chuck. You got to let it
you,
go.
You know what?
What?
You got to stop going to those poetry classes.
No, man, I am learning. I am expanding my mind.
No, it's not reality.
I meant to tell you, this is my last week here.
Fuck.
Yeah.
I can't take two.
I'm sorry.
I cannot take two rejections in 1 week.
Listen, I gotta.
You gotta stay on for another week.
I gotta do me.
No.
Because if you let it go and it flies, then you know it has wings, and I got wings, Chuck. I gotta fly.
I got wings too, but I need another pair of wings to help me fly that thing up to her third floor apartment.
No, you gotta give me your keys, man. I am not letting you out of here.
Okay, so that was really
how was that?
That was really helpful.
Okay,
that was
cool.
Fun.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
It's too, like, I just think patience and, like, curiosity. I don't know. That's what
I mean,
it
so
like.
What I was thinking about, like, okay, what is the why? What is the
I
why?
It,
and
yeah.
I thought to myself, well, he's, so you were like, on what happened last night? And I thought, okay, first it would be tired, right? That seems like it would be the obvious one. And then I thought, okay, the second one was, I don't know why the sad came up or whatever.
Yeah.
But then the sad came up, and then it gave me
everything
a deeper why to it.
Yeah, and I think too, like, I wasn't necessarily being the most helpful, but you can always find keys in what your partner's saying, right? Like, what are you asking me? What is the potential gift that I can get out of what you're telling me? And so I think that was, like, lovely too of you halfway through giving me my why, right?
Well, but I mean, right, but you all, where was your why?
Poetry, man.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you gave a very nice gift, and you said either give me the keys or share a secret.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's a nice thing to keep in your pocket.
Yeah.
Do you use that tool a lot?
What tool?
Share a secret with me?
No, I really don't think that much when I'm on stage. It's all in there, right? So if you've been learning or doing improv for 10 years, all of the things that you've ever done are all in there. So they might be activated by different things. I just think I work more organically, or I'm not aware of the tools that I'm picking up at the point I'm picking it up. When I said, give me your keys, let's see if we want to dissect it. When I said, give me your keys, it's like, that's fun, but it doesn't give him the option to say something. And if the exercise is, I want to get his why, then that's probably what inspired me to do that second half. So that's more of a change.
So do you play that too? Is like, okay, I'm going to try to figure out, I'm going to try to give gifts to help your partner find the why and mm-hmm. vice versa?
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly in classes, I would say. Definitely in classes.
So let's talk about you now touring mm-hmm. all over the country.
Yeah.
Teaching improv.
Yes.
What are you finding?
Oh,
Tell us where you've gone first.
Oh, I've gone so many places. I was just, like I said, in Gladstone. Before that, I was in San Jose, and I was in San Francisco. And before that, I was in Atlanta with my good friend Ryan Archibald, who
was running a theater down there.
Yeah, he's artistic director of the Village Theater, so it was really cool to see that. And before that, I was in Iceland for the Iceland Festival, and then going farther back, more places.
So what are you seeing as you tour around teaching and performing?
I'm seeing how much improv has grown, how much the vocabulary has grown in the past, since I've been doing it, 1,000 years, 15 years. How many more people are doing it, how many small communities are popping up. I also just came from the improv retreat in Wisconsin, which is a beautiful thing, this weird utopian weekend where a bunch of weirdos get together and we're allowed to be who we are and we improvise, but we also support each other.
Campfires?
Oh, yeah, campfires, okay. Yes. Campfires,
s'mores,
bunk beds, all of this stuff.
Bug juice,
yes. So many, yeah.
How's the food?
The food's gross. The food's disgusting, which we all joke about.
You know, I got to ask you because you wanted to be in Second City, you get fired.
Yeah.
You wanted to audition, you wanted to be on Saturday Night Live, you didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're teaching, you're touring around the country. How have you made peace with that?
I think I was talking with a friend the other day, not about these specific things, but about, you know, just life. And I think some of the things you always hold on to, like that's always going to be a part of you. It's always going to be a scar, but it stops being inside of you and it stops changing the way you operate in the world and being able to, that's what I feel like coming to peace with those things mean is, it's not taking away from who I am as a person or changing the way I operate in the world. And so the ability to teach and to direct helped me get my focus back on what I think is important about the work and reminded me of that, I think.
What is important about the work for you?
Of improv, like the magic of improv is openness, communication, and connection. And those things can so easily get lost once you try fighting for – or once you start fighting for spots. Right? Which is like the actor part of it. Like that's a normal actor thing, but that can take some of the magic away.
Is there a part of you that's still, oh, you know, you see your friends, mm-hmm. you know, they've gone on that you've worked with. It's like, oh, I wish I could have that.
No, not those
things. Oh my God.
Things.
Tell me your secret.
Well, I do. I will say like, I'm massively jealous and envious.
Oh, good.
Of
'cause so am I.
Always.
Yes.
But the people like, so there are some people that are successful and being able to have worked with them and known them and then see them gain success fills me up just as much as if it was me. And that's not true about all the people, of course. Like I'm fucking human. But like seeing Amber Ruffin and the way that she's been able to hold on to who she is and that she is who she is on the Seth Meyers show and that she's gaining so much success – is thrilling.
Right. And it also helps. Amber's a very nice person.
She's legitimately a wonderful human.
Yes. And that always makes, to me, that always makes it easier when they're nice.
Yeah.
When they're a jerk and they've gone on to make it, I have a really hard time with that.
I don't watch their shows like that. Like, and that's kind of that's kind of a sad part, I guess, about like when you do this work and you do work with so many people and some people, for whatever reason, you just don't get along with or when you were with them, they were an asshole, which again, doesn't mean they're always an asshole, but when you were with them, you didn't like them. I don't watch the shows that they're on cause I can't. So that's kind of like takes some of the stuff off the table, but there's so much content now. Who cares?
Right. Right. Thank God. You
right?
know, right. Yeah. You know,
I can pick and choose.
Yes, exactly. You also said, that this, the last year and a half was one of those hardest times. As hard as when you got fired from Second City. I didn't want to let that go under the carpet.
Okay.
What was so hard about this year?
Well, it was like 2 years ago I got mugged coming home from a Second City show by gunpoint.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No. And that,
do you want to tell the story?
I mean, that's as much as anyone. Like I was walking home from directing a show.
Here in Old Town.
I was walking home to my Lincoln Park apartment, and someone drove up, jumped out.
What time of the day?
It was like 11 p.m. on a Monday night.
So it's dark out.
It's dark out. The walk is a 30-minute walk. I had done it every day up until that point. takes a gun out, gets my
one, two people?
One person, and then ran back into the car and drove off.
Okay.
And I was like, I had so many, again, so many wonderfully depressive thoughts about that. Of like, he's obviously doing better than I am. He's got a car.
What kind of car was he driving?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I like, yeah, I was also the cop.
The fact that he had a car.
Was like,
yeah,
better than I'm doing.
Right.
And he'd got nothing. So it was also like, you got nothing from me other than like a hat I can't replace and all of my notes. But it was, I had a really bad response. Like it was very traumatic for me.
Was it had to be like post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah. Yeah. So I, Second City very nicely, agreed to pay for psychiatry for me. So I started seeing a psychiatrist and got on pretty heavy antidepressants. And then about 8 months later, those antidepressants sparked a manic episode. And so then I found out I was bipolar, which I did not know. I just thought I was depressed. Easy, easy little depression that everybody is.
Well, had you experienced the highs and lows of being bipolar?
No, maybe. So there's like hypomania, which just for me, if you look back, you can see moments where you're like, oh, I was extra excited or extra obsessed with something, but never any like delusional like this one happened. Like never anything close to that. By any means.
So then they put you on meds for bipolar and they're monitoring it. And
it's terrible. I was hospitalized for 3 days. That's traumatic.
In the psych ward, right?
Yeah. Which, oh, so many great stories. Someday I'll do a one woman show about it. But like basically you're in there. And so they say you're going to be on lithium for the rest of your life and you want them to let you out. So you're like, whatever.
Right.
Great. I'm not crazy. Thank you. So I get out, I'm having a really bad reaction to lithium. They change me to something else. I'm having a really bad reaction to that. And so like the third medication, and then within that finding out, like there was a job that I was up for that I didn't get. And so that
like
was
a crushing,
big job.
You want to tell us?
Mm.
Was it a TV job?
No,
writing
no.
job or something?
No, no, no. It was a directing gig. It was okay. It was a directing gig and it had kind of been like, I was kind of told that I was getting it, and then the manic episode happened, and then the reason that I was told I wasn't getting it was because they didn't want to stress me out. So instead, they threw me into a massive depressive episode by stressing me out. So it's like kind of that mental health thing where it's like, I was still dealing with it, so I'm still finding the words, but boy, do I think they handled it poorly. We'll see.
We've got to wrap this up.
Perfect place to end.
What one piece of advice, we always end the podcast the same way, would you give someone starting out in improv today?
Enjoy it. Be open and be curious.
Andiel Sukit? Sudik? Did
Sudik.
Sudik.
Yeah.
I got it right.
You nailed it.
I nailed it, didn't I?
First name you nailed, which never happens.
Andiel?
Yeah.
Well, because I had worked with you and I, but the last name I still struggle with. Thank you so much for being our guest on this episode of Improv Nerd.
Thank you.
And there you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank our guest, Andiel Sudik, and just her honesty and her thoughtfulness about improvisation. I just want to thank her again. Also, I'd like to thank the Second City Training Center for providing us a space to record this episode of Improv Nerd, as well as my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, workshops, and summer intensives, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. Also, follow us on all the social media. Facebook, like our Improv Nerd fan page, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd. Go to our new YouTube channel, which is Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word. And of course, support our Patreon page. We are putting more content on there for to become better improv teachers. So it's Patreon/Improv Nerd. Also, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Nerd is a nerd.